Hi, Internet. My name is Jonathan Matos.
And this is Melissa Matos.
Welcome to Unboxing Story, where we unpack fiction without the friction. Today, we're talking about Cats Don't Dance, one of my favorite. Like, there's so much nostalgia in my heart right now. I can't even. Now, you kind of mentioned that you would kind of see me watching this, maybe.
Yes.
But we're just like, oh, it's a kid's, he's enjoying a kid's movie.
Good for him.
You know, but like, this was something that was, I mentioned while we were going over the show notes that, like, what I liked about it was like watching like Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck and stuff like that. There was, and then it's like, it seemed like there was a new school of animation where it's like Pinky and the Brain.
Right.
Where they're like making fun of Bill Clinton and stuff in a kid's show. And so it was funny because I looked up to these animators in the sense that they were making these jokes that were over my head, but I could still tell that they were funny. And it seemed like they were trying to make each other laugh by doing the shows. And so, like, I was like, oh, that's cool. So then Cats Don't Dance was such a revelation to me because it was like really funny slapstick humor that I got, you know, pretty obviously. But then there were all these things about Hollywood. And so we're going to, as this is like a breaking genre episode, we're going to kind of talk about this being a cartoon, an animation from the late 90s. That's aware that it's a musical. For those of you who haven't seen this, it's a Warner Brothers John. And it's coming during the time of what they call the Disney Renaissance.
Right.
And so you're getting all of these,
like Beauty and the Beast and all that stuff coming out.
Like, they're kind of like these big prestige pictures. Yeah. And there is one sense in which they're trying to be these big musicals, but animated. This is the story of a cat from a small town wants to make it big in Hollywood. And animals are not, like, they're kind of like second fiddle.
Right. They're not considered actors. They just do animal parts.
Right. They do bit parts and stuff. And the big show in the movie is a little archangel. And it's a Noah's Ark thing, but it's like a parody of Noah's Ark with a Shirley Temple-esque main character in the movie within a movie named Darla Dimple. And, like, it's everything. Like, you kind of mentioned that, like, it's so funny how villainous she is.
Oh, she's horrible. She's terrifying. That chick is scary.
But it's like, in that way that, like, you know, in those older cartoons, there was just, like, you kind of expected that there's the scrappy, you know, young hero, and then there's the dastardly villain. Like, it's that kind of classic cartoon thing. But they are kind of making references throughout the whole thing to different character archetypes. It's one of the reasons why I like it so much, because, like you were saying, The turtle sounds like Don Knotts.
Yes. Yeah.
And so the whole time his voice is shaking.
The fish is very Betty Davis kind of.
Mm-hmm.
And then Tilly, I'm not sure exactly what actress Tilly is, but I know that's a type, like the big loud actress that like Annie Mame sing at the top of your lungs all the time kind of person.
Right.
That kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. And it's kind of that version of when movies were just an extension of the theater kind of thing.
Right.
Like, you had all these big musicals, and all the actors knew how to sing and dance and, all that stuff.
Yeah, it was fun because it felt like a throwback to old Hollywood and old Warner Brothers style stuff. Like, everything was hand-drawn. There was no CGI anything in that movie.
Right.
And it was all beautifully hand-drawn. Like,
right.
My favorite character, drawing-wise, was the female cat. What's her name again? Sawyer.
Sawyer.
How can I forget Sawyer? Sawyer's my man. Her name is Sawyer. And she just, like, they managed to somehow make her very classy, old school Hollywood star, like, and still be a cat. And I don't know how they did that.
And it's interesting because my sister and I have been talking about well-rounded romance for the past, like, week or so. And I like this setup where he's this very naive guy who thinks of himself as the type of guy that just meets a girl and they fall instantly in love and he sweeps her off her feet and stuff. And she's this kind of hardened, you know, realist.
I've been through this before, whatever. Right.
But it's this classic setup of, you know, him melting her heart and stealing, you know. And it fills me with the warm fuzzies. And I like that as part of the makeup of it, that he inspires all of them to remember why they came to Hollywood in the first place. And a lot of that is through the music, which I forgot how well done.
Yeah, the music is great.
The music is. I like the closing numbers. Nothing's gonna stop us. Nothing's gonna stop us. Nothing's gonna stop. It kind of reminds me of like Hercules.
Yeah.
That was a really fun, upbeat.
Right. Cause they made it, semi gospel-y bluesy for most of it. It's not like typical Broadway stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It's more like the bluesy side of Broadway stuff.
Right.
So it was nice. And the villain song. I love the villain song. It's so ridiculous.
Big and loud.
Like, straight up crazy.
Yeah.
I don't know what that was, but it was great.
Yeah, because to round back to her, she is a version of Shirley Temple as if she was secretly a psychopath.
Yes.
Right? And so you kind of get that, like, Elmer Fudd thing of, like, always, you know, Elmer Fudd and Wile E. Coyote are always, like, that, like, their whole character is they're being completely, they're the buffoonish bad guy.
Right.
Or like at the whole thing with her is that she, because she's so tiny, Max is her bodyguard. It's this huge, like, gorilla looking character. And like, by huge, I don't mean like the size of a gorilla.
No, like ridiculous. He is like 3 stories tall.
Yeah. 30, you know, it's, and they kind of make earlier on, they make reference to King Kong.
Right.
So I think that's kind of what he's supposed to symbolize from old Hollywood. But,
I was telling John, we need to watch Sunset Boulevard next because he is literally the name of the butler for the main character in Sunset Boulevard.
And that it's funny for you because you're a fan of noir movies. And so there were references to all kinds of old Hollywood, Hollywood musicals. And I just, it was funny to watch this and realize as an adult how much exposure I must have had to classic movies to have gotten
to some of that
as a kid. Because I would see like there's the part where they do the red carpet. There's actual old Hollywood stars like Betty Davis, Clark Gable, Cary Grant. And like, if you like that era, you'll love like all the different stuff that they do in this movie. They replace the lion of MGM with a woolly mammoth. And so every now and again, they'll have the classic thing where they actually had a lion do the roar. They have him do, like, he trumpets his thing. And he kind of represents the spirit of old Hollywood.
Right.
Because when there's that first kind of, like, slap in the face of what Hollywood's really like, the main cat and his little penguin friend go to, they hear this piano, and they wonder why it's coming from. They go to his trailer, and he kind of, like, you know, it's kind of this thing of, like, he hasn't forgotten. You know,
right. He hasn't forgotten what it was like.
And so I feel like I've been ranting.
not renting. Exuberanting? Is that a word?
Whatever the verb form of exuberant is.
Yes. That is what he's doing.
Is there anything that you would like to explore with this thing? Because, like I said, there's like five layers of nostalgia.
Yes.
That I have for it.
I mean, I loved the throwback to old Hollywood. I liked how it was even a theme for old Hollywood. Like, I could have seen this it being a movie that Gene Kelly made, you know, like, it could have been the same story.
Right.
Okay, so the one big thing, and I forgot to give this to in the show notes ahead of time. Scott Bakula. Really? Like, I saw him in the credits, and I'm like, wait, who's Scott Bakula voicing for this? And then I heard the cat singing, and I'm like, Scott Bakula sings? Like, when did that happen?
Right.
So for those of you who don't know, because some of you might be fans of my brother instead of me and not into the sci-fi scene. So Scott Bakula, in addition to being the dude on Quantum Leap, is also the captain of Enterprise for the Enterprise version of Star Trek.
Yeah.
And I just never pictured that man singing, ever. Mm-hmm. And now here he is voicing a cartoon cat and singing like a pro. And it just floored me, like, a lot. So there's that. I actually had to look up the turtle. I looked him up twice because I swore up and down he was Don Knotts. He sounded so much like him.
Uh-huh.
But he wasn't. But so the acting in this, it wasn't just like nowadays where you just pick name star A because people will come see a cartoon with name star A in it.
Right.
Like, they picked people that were really good at what they did, right? Right. So he did both the voice and the singing for the boy cat, and then the girl cat was
Jasmine Guy.
Jasmine Guy did the voice acting, yeah, part, and Natalie Cole did the singing. So like, that alone is just like, hey there, like, let's go listen to these songs.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like they're like, you wouldn't consider them like, you know, A-list stars, like the people they get, like, now they just get, what's his name, Justin Bieber, or whatever superstar crazy nonsense is going on at the time, whether they're good at whatever they're doing or not. But they pick people that are both good at the voice acting and at being in a Hollywood-style film. Right. Like, I thought that was really cool. And they weren't afraid to still use a lot of the old tropes that people loved about Warner Brothers cartoons when it was just Bugs Bunny, right? Like, there were some typical comedic beats in there of, like, people getting hit with pianos and blah, blah, blah. But it was still funny because Warner Brothers, like, invented that stuff and they know exactly when make you laugh.
I mentioned when they were in the trailer, it's funny because it's an elephant.
Yeah.
So, like, what's cute about it is that there are these two smaller characters. And so every time he makes a step, it's like
the whole trailer shifts.
And so it's this thing of, like, them getting, like, thrown across the room and he's completely oblivious to that happening to them. But then it works out perfectly where when he turns around, they're both just, like, sitting in, like, his flower pot or something.
But they were also still witty with the script itself. Like, it wasn't just Pratt's, you know, slapstick comedy stuff. The script itself was also fun.
Right.
And, it was fun all around. Good stuff.
So I think after the break, I'll attempt to get, without getting too into the weeds, something that is at, like, a deeper level to it. So I feel like there are some things that are for adults, but what I enjoy about it is that it's not, like, depressing, or it's not, like you were saying, just going for the joke. So we shall get there after the break.
And we're back!
I was not expecting that. So I think the perfect example to use for a point about this is in the Shrek movie, there's a part where they're going to Duloc, where the villain lives, and there's this thing of, like, there's, like, this animatronic thing, and it sings It's a Small World.
Kind of.
But it's his parody of it. So you can get that it's like a shot over the bow of like, this isn't like somebody calling, like if the villain was named Disney.
Right.
And there was like this whole thing, like you could make the case that like the Lego movie is a bigger like treatise on capitalism and its intersection with the entertainment industry and stuff like that. But like with that, it's just like this joke that's in it. But what I like about Cats Don't Dance is that there is this kind of thing of like, okay, Disney owns this like musical thing, this animated musical thing. And they choose to do the same thing, but they don't have to be, number one, they're not copying them.
Right.
There's not that like, I mean, there's kind of like an I Want song, right? But it's not, it seemed to me like it had its own personality.
Yeah, it was different, right? than a typical Disney plot movie.
Yeah. And it had its own personality, like without taking a lot, like a dozen cheap shots. Like it needs to.
Like DreamWorks feels like they take a lot of cheap shots at Disney. Mm. Like they came out with Ants when Disney did Bug's Life.
Right.
And there's like certain things that you can tell they're like, oh, we're the edgier whatever side of things instead of being like Disney, but they don't seem to have the same like standalone ideas. I mean, there might be some exceptions, obviously. I'm not saying DreamWorks doesn't come up with anything.
Not like they only do that, but sometimes they do.
But Warner Brothers has its own thing. It has its own feeling. It has its own ideas. And this one showcases those.
And I'd actually make that case because throughout this whole movie, I was saying, like, you have to remember the time frame of when this is, right? But then I was thinking, but I think that's actually a big reason why DC's cartoons did so well. Not just because, okay, DC is this recognized property. It has all these built-in character recognition. It's because they picked Warner Brothers.
Right.
And Warner Brothers had great animators in their studio. And that's why people remember Batman, the animated series. And that's why...
Did they do Gargoyles too?
I don't know.
It felt like them. If they didn't, I don't know.
But that might actually be a case, because I know Disney owns Gargoyles. So that might actually be a case of the reverse, where Warner Brothers owned, you know, cartoons for boys at that time.
Right.
They're like, we need to make it look like that.
Yeah.
Now, I'd say the writing on Gargoyles time, it was certainly its own show.
Right.
But as far as the animation, it looked like Batman the Animated Series, that style of stuff. And so that, I felt like they started with their TV series to really, like, even though it's DC's characters, they made DC's, like, they're still pumping out animated movies, DVDs for DC.
From those things. They should have done a Superman cartoon. That would have been really cool.
But that's the thing, is that it's so interesting to me that they're still, because of the straight-to-DVD movie, it's the one studio that I hear people compliment all the time.
Yeah.
Just as like, oh, did you see this version of this cartoon thing? And it's like, you know, they're doing a Teen Titans cartoon and then the Teen Titans Go cartoon and they're meeting each other.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And so like it's a really fun like studio that's still really doing good stuff. And I think this was one where it's strange to me that more people don't know about Cats Don't Dance, because it seems like such a good quality film that people just don't remember because it was kind of in the middle of the Disney renaissance.
And maybe not as many people are as nostalgic about old school Hollywood as we are.
Right. So that's what I think is a big part of it.
People that catch on to it. I think maybe too, I don't know as much about how Warner Brothers Studios feels now, but I know originally they were very similar to Disney in the sense of they felt very much like a family. Like those artists were like, this was their life and this is what they were dedicated to, and they were dedicated to each other and helping each other become better artists and all that. Like it was a very mentorship kind of thing. The way that Disney kind of did theirs, like it was just, this is the nine guys and you're going to teach everybody else who ever works here how exactly we do everything. And like, it's a very vision-centered philosophy, right? Like Warner Brothers has a vision and this is what our vision is and this is what we're sticking to and all of our stuff is going to be.
Right, because I would make the case that even though I think it was Don Bluth's studio did things like All Dogs Go to Heaven, and I'm pretty sure Don Bluth Studio did Secret of NIMH.
Oh, really?
For some reason, they didn't kind of create a
because I wouldn't necessarily put those two together
as a studio, right?
Right.
And so it wasn't really a particular thing. They had different people doing, and like Thumbelina.
Right.
There's this way in which they didn't standardize like right. a house style. That didn't
feel like the same studio to me.
Right. And so you don't get the same like loyalty in terms of brand that you do with Disney, where you're like, okay, this is a Disney movie. Disney movies kind of all have this specific look right. and feel to them.
Right.
And I would go one further in that it's interesting to me, and I don't really know, I'd like to talk about it because I don't really know how to put my finger on it. But there's something specific about how Warner Brothers did, from the beginning, satire show business
mm-hmm.
that makes it seem more genuine, like a love letter, than modern versions of that.
Right.
So, like, you think of the Hound. There's the not Huckleberry Finn. What's the Droopy Dog? There's this Droopy Dog cartoon where the Hound is watching the sexy singer.
Oh, right.
And the Hound is like following him around and he can't like get rid of him, and there's just something about the fact that it was big during the 40s that they defined their house style during that time, so that looking at Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck and all those characters, there's still this feeling of
right there's a very different association with that time,
right?
And I think satiring it in a loving way, so that's not even right, satire is not the right word then, parodying it in a loving way.
Mm-hmm.
Because, so, like, you have, even in the originals, like, with Bugs Bunny and such, you have them drawing famous Hollywood actors that happen to be walking by the studio all the time, throwing right. them into their cartoons. You have them doing movies like this where they're like, oh, yeah, we know what Hollywood is. We've been here forever. Uh-huh. We got this. And then I was just watching Tiny Toons the other night with the nieces, where they're literally parodying themselves.
Uh-huh.
Like, it's, let's introduce a whole second generation of these guys and have the first generation be teaching them. But this is now your generation of cartoons, because Looney Tunes, Tiny Tunes, between Tiny Tunes, Animaniacs, and Pinky and the Brain, that was, like, huge for my generation coming up. That was a big deal. And that was still us, like, how we saw the world.
Right.
But in this framework of, let's remember how to still laugh at ourselves, that Warner Brothers always had.
Right.
Yeah. So I really appreciate what they keep doing, and that I hope they keep doing it.
Mm-hmm.
And,
And I've seen some of the, like I said, like, some of their studios now dedicated to the DC branch. But then I saw some clips from a newer Looney Tunes cartoon, and it still had that sense of personality where it wasn't, what's Bugs Bunny going to do in high school? Yeah. Like,
no,
that type of weird thing. They invented
new kids to be in high school so that it didn't have to be Bugs. Bugs was the teacher. Like, right. why are you CWing yourself? This is nonsense. Welcome to the next generation. Try it that way. And I think they hit pretty good at doing that. Like, it was, Tiny Toons was huge, and Animaniacs was even huger, because Animaniacs was like, talk about satire.
Mm-hmm.
They were all over that.
And I think, now that I think of it, like, I feel like Archie is kind of failing in that department, where they had this very wholesome brand from, like, with its root in the 40s and stuff. And while all these other comics were thinking, okay, we need to update our stuff. So, like, my case for Marvel is, like, reading Ms. Marvel, reading Miles Morales' Spider-Man, I feel like I'm reading the comics I grew up with. And I know there's this whole big Comicsgate thing, but I appreciate that, like, the ethos of these characters remains that anybody could be Spider-Man. Spider-Man is just a kid that gets bit by a spider.
Right.
And all of a sudden has all this responsibility. Miss Marvel is somebody that, you know, is a woman trying to do the right thing. And it's cool to see her be, like you're saying, this new generation thing. She is a fangirl of superheroes, but you're just seeing it from the perspective of a Muslim
right.
teenager who, and, you know, as the son of somebody that wasn't from mainland America, it's interesting to see how they interpret this kind of what would you call it? Intersectional thing of, like, she's a teenager and she's Muslim, but she's from Jersey.
Right.
And she has, like, a very Orthodox brother that she doesn't get along with. But then all the, you know, white, like, Christian kids at school just make fun of her. So she doesn't necessarily look up to them. But superheroes are, like, her idols. She's right. like, I want to be like Miss Marvel. And so it's about her interpreting how she, as a Muslim teenager, is going to be like Miss Marvel, who wears, like, a bikini.
Right.
And, like, do you get all these things that, like, are just a teenage thing? It's not. So what I would make the case for with Archie is that they changed it to be a CW type yeah. thing. They changed the identity of what the original core thing is. And so I feel like you can get, and that's, like, kind of how I feel about, like, Gotham and the shows like that, is that it, I don't necessarily, like, that whole thing of, like, you ruined my childhood, not necessarily that you ruined it, but you are taking the identity of this thing and distracting me from what the original thing is.
Right.
So, like, I know that all that's, all the comics that I own, not like they go away, I can still read those,
right.
but I know that you could have done it better than what you're doing it.
Right.
So it just is slightly upsetting.
I think things like Marvel and even Disney did a really good job, and Warner Brothers, like we're talking about, did a really good job of identifying the good parts of the past. Because obviously there were bad parts too. There are some Disney cartoons that you cannot show now because they are that racist.
Without Whoopi Goldberg
explaining what's going on.
Why this is not right.
But they took the good cores of those things. Like, for Warner Brothers, that, like, parody of, you know, we gotta laugh at ourselves or it isn't worth doing. Or, like, for Disney, the whole, like, love is a transcendent thing and we're not just talking about romance, although that was a big part of the older ones. Now it's, you know, siblings or whatever, but this is still, love is what's defeating evil.
Right.
Or, what was the other one you just mentioned? That we appreciated. I don't remember what anyway. But, like, with the CW, they're not taking any kind of core values that people appreciated in the old thing and bringing it forward to now. What they're doing, oh, you were talking about Marvel. Marvel did that in a huge way with the superheroes, because they're like, people want heroes. People want for real heroes. Like, yes, we had anti-heroes, and that's a big deal, and people still like those too. But hey, we need some heroes right now. So let's figure out what people want in heroes now and bring that forward with these guys. But then stuff like the CW, they don't take any kind of core anything and bring that forward into the thing. They're just like, oh, we need racy teenage drama.
Right.
And they will put that into whatever
you
property
plug
they have
into
all of it. And I'm like, obviously, apparently somebody's watching this nonsense, but I don't understand it.
Because what it feels like is rather than, so I think the bad way to criticize it is to do the whole, you're messing up my childhood, because that your childhood is your childhood.
Yeah.
Nobody can do anything to that. But the whole idea of it feels like a Frankenstein, right?
Yeah.
So you have the bits of tissue that you liked.
You put the face on top of some weird
right, yeah,
underframe that I no longer understand.
Mm-hmm. So, like, you have the Sheen, you have the, you know, what's the name? The guy that eats the cheeseburgers.
The guy that eats the cheeseburgers?
Jughead, that's his name.
Okay.
He still goes to a burger joint. He still has
that weird
the hat. But they morphed it into, he's an emo loner who's taking a journal, and he knows everyone's secrets. It's like, that's not Jughead.
That's not Jughead.
Literally, all Jughead's characters.
Is he?
Well, not just that, but, like, like taking the, like it was a romance, but it was, the idea of it was that it was this quintessential thing. And so you can do things to question whether that type of place really exists. But to make it so that the way that you do that is to have Archie, like, is he sleeping with his teacher? It's just like, no, I don't, not my Archie. Maybe your Archie is.
Yeah, but nope.
I don't think so.
And even if you were going to do that, you could do something like Once Upon a Time, where instead of necessarily just making it, although they did make that very soap opera-y, it wasn't always that ridiculous. And they, the more, it was more fun just having a mashup of all the favorite fairy tales. So, like, they should have done the whole Archer Meets the Punisher thing. Because that would have been more relevant and less, I don't know.
Yeah, because I think that that's the thing is that I appreciate...
Archie Meets the Punisher, not Archer.
Although
Archer Meets the Punisher, I might actually watch that one. I don't watch Archer, but I'd watch that.
So that we don't end this on a sour note. I'll explain what that is, because it's a very fun story. So at some thrift store or some garage sale or something, I picked up an issue that was Archie Meets the Punisher. And it, before you read the comic, there's two letters from the editor, both the editor of Archie and the editor of Punisher. And they both start off their letter with, it started as a joke. So apparently two says, the one from Marvel starts, we were playing golf, talking about the distinguished competitor, because that's what they call DC. And they were joking about whether it would be fun to do this. And they both went back, talked to their editor-in-chief, and it was just like, why not? So they did this thing where there's a character in Riverdale who goes from some, you know, horrible city, maybe Philadelphia, who knows, into Riverdale. But he looks just like Archie. And so the Punisher is trying to track this drug dealer down. Meanwhile, there's this whole comedy of errors thing, because everybody thinks that this guy that looks like Archie
is Archie.
Is Archie, and he's like swearing, and they have all the like, the planet and the X and the exclamation points and stuff. Like, holy
crap. Sam swearing.
Yeah. And he's like hitting on multiple, you know, women, and Archie's like getting in trouble for all this stuff. But then you get the Punisher, who like does not belong in this universe.
No, not at all.
And that same Mrs. Griswold is like completely in love with him and all this stuff. So it's like, it's a really fun thing, but that, I think you hit the nail on the head in that you can have some things that comment on the fact that, like, that having Punisher in this universe immediately recontextualizes it. One good example that is, I'm watching Outlander now, and what the original factor of it is, we were kind of talking about how, like, all of these romance novels are very anachronistic. Or esoteric, I should say. And so, like, you're seeing how there's this version of masculinity that is lost. And all of these stories are about getting back to this very romantic time. So what Outlander does to recontextualize that is, okay, what if we took a nurse that just got fresh off of World War I and plopped her back into, like, the 1700s in Scotland? And so what's funny is that obviously this is like they spend like the first episode really romanticizing like all the druidic stuff, and like, you know, her husband is fascinated by history. And so there's all this stuff, but she is genuinely in love with her husband. But then all of a sudden she's back in time and she starts falling for this other guy. And so what's funny about this is that you get this much more organically, you get this commentary on this other time.
Right.
So I feel like if I were to do Archie, I'd want to still have it be Archie in some manner. Like, another good example is the very Brady movie.
I was going to say, you could do like the Brady Bunch.
Where, like, they all, the humor in it was, they were still the Brady Bunch. in a modern
1990s,
era.
And you're like, it's not gonna work.
And so, like, yeah, so it, I mean, like I said, it's hard to be very, very serious about this Cats Don't Dance movie. It's not like I'm gonna reinvent the wheel talking about this thing.
No, but it was fun.
But yeah, it's fun, and I like how it did the conversation about animated movies and what they can be. So you should watch it. You should find a clamshell VHS.
Yes.
Then find a way to play
then
that.
Then find a VHS player.
Good luck.
Somewhere.
No, but we found it on Amazon. So yes. If you want to see it.
It does exist. In digital.
Yes. Yeah. it has been archived by the great supercomputer gods for your viewing pleasure. So we're going to be at Evil Expo. I believe it's January 24th to 26th.
Somewhere in there. End of January.
Yeah. And if you want to hear me talk more about Bad Boys, that's going to be one of our conversations. Because things. I don't know. I just ran out of steam. Oh.
And be watching for Kyanite Press coming out in November 1st, containing my Iron Sorcerer story. And other beautiful fantasy things. There are, I think, 10 different stories in it this time.
Uh-huh. So, very good.
Available for pre-order at KyanitePress.com.
Huzzah. All right, thank you for listening, and we shall see you later.
Bye.